The following interview was conducted with Wayne Keim for the Purdue University Oral History Program. It took place on Friday, November the 16th, 2007, in the Stewart Center. The interviewer is Catherine Marquis, the Oral History Librarian. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also sitting in is his wife Joyce and Valerie Yazoo, the Oral History or the Diversity Fellow. Go ahead. Welcome. Tell us a little bit about where you were born and your parents and early years.
Okay. I was born in Ithaca, New York, while my father was a graduate student at Cornell University. And he was on leave back and forth from, he had a full-time job at the University of Nebraska, and he just went back and forth from Nebraska to Cornell whenever he could get a leave of absence. And so I was 6 months old then when my family moved back to Lincoln, Nebraska. So that's where I grew up, in Lincoln. And went through the public school system there.
How large was the town at that time?
Oh, about 80,000, I think. Something like that. And now I have my wife with me, and she's going to help me remember things because she's got a better memory than I do, because it was a long time ago that when we moved from Ithaca, New York to Lincoln, Nebraska. That was 84 years ago. Okay. And so then I grew up in Lincoln, and then I graduated from the University of Nebraska. And
what was your major?
My major was agronomy and mathematics. I had a double major. I had spent some time in the Army, 3 years in the U.S. Army during World War II, but I was fortunate in that the Army sent me to college most of the time, some of the time. And so then shortly after I graduated in 1947 from the University of Nebraska, I married my bride, who sits beside me here. 60 years ago this summer, we were married. And then, do you want me to continue on?
Yeah, tell us what college, though, what campus
was. Well, I was.
What was it like in the
campus?
It was during the war.
No, it was after. I got out of the service in 46. The war ended in 45, and then I think it's typical college for those days. University of Nebraska is a interesting situation in that it has separate campuses. The so-called Ag campus is about 3 miles from the downtown campus, and so we were busy going back and forth from one campus to the other. Then what else can I say about the university?
Did you live on campus?
No. Oh. My dad was on the faculty at the University of Nebraska. So when I got back from the service, I had part of my education before the military, and then I finished up afterwards, and I had only a year, a little more than a year to finish. And so I stayed at home because my parents' home was just a block south of the Ag campus. And then that's when I met Joyce. And
was she a student there at that time?
She was a student there, and we graduated the same time. And even though we were in different colleges, they let us walk down the aisle together to get our diplomas. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Surprised I can remember. But so it was a...
What was her major? What school was she in?
Psychology. She was...
In arts and sciences.
In those days, they called it arts and sciences. May still call it College of Arts and Science. And she was a psychology major. She's been using her psychology on me ever since.
And what was the career path after that? Tell us a little bit about what you did after you graduated.
Okay, I decided to go to graduate school. And so I went to Cornell University, where my dad had gone, in the same department that he went, 20-some years later, and got a master's and a Ph.D. in plant breeding and genetics. And so it was a... I've often thought about it. We always had my dad had very little influence on my career, but I imagine he did have a lot of it, because I took my first course in genetics at the University of Nebraska from him. That's what he taught.
How does it be to be in a class with you?
Well, I tell you, I worked harder in that class than I ever worked before, because I knew I was supposed to get an A. And in fact, I think I let other courses slide a little bit so that I could be sure to get an A in that course, and did.
That's interesting.
And by the way, before I forget it, then when I taught genetics here at Purdue, our son, went through my course and took genetics with me, and he said the same thing.
He must have heard you say that.
It was pressure, pressure, pressure. And of course, all of his buddies gave him a bad time about taking a course with me, you know. But
getting an A.
And he got his A. He had to work to get it, and I think he let other things slide.
What was it like at Cornell in those days at that time? Was the campus like?
Well, I have been there except to visit about twice in all those years, but it's a very elegant place, and the buildings are older, and a lot of them are old. There's a lot of new ones, too. But they have lots of money there, and their endowment is very high. Cornell University is the land-grant university for New York State, but curiously enough, not 100% of it. Part of it is, and part of it isn't.
It's quasi, right.
It was a great university, and I was not interested in staying back in the East when we finished, because I have nothing against the East, but I'm a Midwesterner, and I just liked it out this way. And so,
well, then when you finished, tell us what to do.
Then when we finished there, and then I took my first job at Iowa State University in Ames, and we were there. And we loved Ames. It was a great town. It's a small town. For a college town, it's very small. But the university is very, very, especially in my area, very strong. And we've been lucky in all of our career to be at places where the university was strong in my field. I ended up being what I call plant breeding and genetics. So we stayed at Ames, Iowa, 3.5 years. And then took a job at Purdue University.
How did that come about?
Well, we didn't have the old affirmative action, equal opportunity. And so the boss here, Dr. J.B. Peterson, was a very good friend of the boss at Iowa State, Wendell Pogonier. And the genetics job here turned up. And so when my boss at Iowa State heard about it, and they were old buddies, he called up and talked to JB about my coming here, and so that's the way it happened. Pretty soon we were back here interviewing for a job, and that was 1955.
Okay, what was the housing, and were you able to find, what was it like?
Here it was bad. It was very difficult, and we lived in I'm not sure you'd call it temporary housing, but we lived out on David Ross Road. On David Ross Road out.
It was experimental housing.
It was out there by the big tower, water tower. And the houses, we didn't suffer any, but it was.
They were temporary houses that had been built, I think, for that time.
Or, right.
Yeah. And I've heard that from other people around that era, yeah, too.
Weren't they built by the
National Homes?
National Homes,
yes.
Some of them.
It was on a hill. Remember, for a while we lived at the bottom of the hill.
Yeah.
And when it rained, the water came down, and we had a geyser in our kitchen.
Yeah, it was quite a deal.
Up through the floor.
Did you have children by that time?
Yes, we had.
We had two.
Three.
Two then, and then our youngest was born.
Born.
While we were there.
Okay.
House. That's right. Mm-hmm. One child was born in Ithaca, New York, and one was born in Ames, Iowa. And then one was born in Lafayette, over in home hospital, they called it. Yeah, that's.
Well, tell us how when you got started. And I know I want to ask you about Peterson because he was the head for a long
time. That's right.
All the time that you were here.
Yeah, right. Well, do you want to know how, why I got here? Why?
Yeah.
The genetics course, the introductory genetics course that was required of a lot of students, they had three separate courses taught. One was in biology, one was in animal science, and one was in poultry. It had poultry department in those days. And R.B. Stewart actually had quite a bit to do about this, but he said that's not very efficient to have three separate courses. And so they decided that they really ought to have just one course. And naturally, each one of those three departments wanted to teach this course. And R.B. was there, according to what I wasn't there. And R.B. said to the people, since each one of them wanted it, to solve the problem, he turned to J.B. Peterson and said, is there any reason that agronomy can't teach the beginning genetics course? And Dr. Peterson was kind of taken back by it all, because they had never taught that course. And he was a very tremendous man. He said, sure, we can do it without any hesitation. And so that's the way it worked out. And so when we got here...
This had taken place before you came, this discussion.
Yes, that's right. And when we got here in January of 1956, I was developing then a new course. And I had good cooperation from the various people involved, I remember. And there was no animosity. And in fact, some of them were probably, I think, kind of glad to get rid of the course because it was hard work, because we had large enrollments. And so then I took over. And when I got here, the life science building was just half done. So the west wing was there and the east wing was not there. And so my office was temporarily in the west wing. And I remember Dr. Peterson told the people around here, well, he couldn't do it unless they gave him more space. And so my office and labs were in the east wing of the life science building, and that was the only part of agronomy that was in the east wing. And so we had new facilities, and we started out in, as I said, January of 56, and then the course was successful, and then we got bigger and bigger and bigger as far as enrollment is concerned. But that's kind of the...
How you got started.
How
was
I got
the building still under construction? We're under construction at the time you came here, so just one wing was finished?
One wing was finished, mm-hmm. and then they built the second wing when we were teaching. And so I was teaching in temporary quarters until that building was finished. So then I had new offices, and it was very good. And they did the right thing. It wasn't just a matter of going into the facilities and without any help. And so they lined up so that I had one graduate teaching assistant at all times, and sometimes two, as it built, as the part. And then our course, it was called Agronomy 430 in those days. That was a required course for many students. And my largest student enrollment was pre-vets. There were, one time I calculated that 42% of my students were pre-vets. And that was a fun experience because everybody that's a pre-vet wants to be a veterinarian. And so you don't have to worry about them studying and getting working toward good grades. So it was easy. And my students were excellent students.
This was before the vet school started, wasn't it?
Yes,
well. Because it was 59, didn't it open?
Yeah, I remember when it opened. And in fact, you'll be interested that the very first year that the vet school opened, they didn't have a full quorum of students. I'm guessing now, but I think in those days, 60 was a class, and I think they had 52 or something like that because it was new, brand new, and they really started before they were ready to start, I think. But it was an interesting experience. So in those years I was here, I had the first group of veterinarians, the older veterinarians here in the state, that graduated from Purdue, were my students.
If before the school opened, did you have pre-vet or not?
I don't think so.
Because there was no vet. That's the only vet school in the state still is this one.
Yeah, and I remember the man, the first dean of the vet school.
That Erskine Morris?
No, we knew him quite well.
Okay.
But there was another one before him. In fact, I don't want to be pessimistic, but the first veterinary dean died of some sort of a animal disease.
There was one. He was not there too long or something.
Yes,
I remember. The school was going to be celebrating their anniversary in 2009.
Oh, really?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that...
So
that I've always said, having the vet students in class helped keep the level of the course up because, and I used to have some students complain that weren't a vet student because they said the level of the course was too high for the average student. But the vet students, now they weren't all outstanding. And one time the dean told me that they looked very carefully at the grades that the pre-vets got in my class because they knew that we were having a good, rigid class. And if they got an A, and if they didn't get an A in my class, well, then they looked...
Interesting. What were the students like? Did you interact? Most of them were from overall, and the students...
I always had good students here, I think. And people wouldn't believe me sometimes when I... You know, talk about how qualified the students were, and they were, well, a lot of it, you know, is motivation. They were motivated because they wanted to get into vet school. That's the easiest motivation there is. And, but it was a fun experience, and we stayed here 19 and a half years.
Did you continue with your research while you're here as well as
Yes,
teaching?
But yes, except that I want to make sure to emphasize that my department head here was J.B. Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
And J.B.
I was going to ask you a little bit about
okay.
him. Okay. Yeah.
You want me to do that now?
Yes, sure.
J.B. Peterson came from Iowa State, and he was a teacher there. He did research too, but he was a teacher, and he didn't believe in any 50-50 appointments. And so my appointment here at Purdue was 80% teaching, 20% research. And I doubt if there were very many people as fortunate as I that had a department head that was so enthusiastic about teaching. And more than once when I would get enthusiastic about expanding my research, he told me that, look, he says, I can find 10 good researchers for every good teacher I can find. So get back down there and teach your genetics course. And I enjoyed that. I think I had 7,000 students in the 20 years we were here, 19 and a half years.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to say I've been thinking a little bit about Dr. Peterson. He backed me from the beginning. And I got promoted in the minimum amount of time on basis of my teaching. And that's kind of unheard of in this day and age. But
it's key to the university, teaching.
That's right. Well, that's what I've said. And my career has been that same way.
Uh-huh.
And so I've always been more than half, usually 75 or 80% teaching wherever I've been. But Dr. Peterson was a remarkable man, and he had a remarkable wife, Beth, and they had more esprit de corps in the department than you can imagine. We were in J.B. Peterson's house, and Beth Peterson played the piano by ear, any tune, any key you wanted, and everybody was singing, and it was a unusual experience, I think, to be with him and with them. So, let's see, is there anything else I should say about
him? Go ahead if you have anything else. But I also wanted to ask you, you mentioned about R.V. Stewart and the TIA and CREF.
Yes.
You mentioned this to me on the phone.
Okay. I had been here just a year, I think, and a notice came around that a meeting was being held in the Elliott Hall of Music and expected everybody to be there. Well, that kind of a notice.
That's a huge facility.
Yes, it is, and usually, you know, we're going to have a seminar today, and then you have to decide whether you think it's worth your time to go to a seminar. But the way this was worded and everything, everybody, what's going on? What's going on? And so
this was sent to the faculty?
Yes. And I think the administration, department heads and everybody. And so I remember walking over to the student center with Ralph Davis, who was one of my colleagues in the department. I said, what's going on? He said, I have the slightest idea. And never did we ever have meetings in this Elliott Hall. That's a big place. And we got over there, and R.B. Stewart got up and said, I have an idea that I want to share with you people, and that is having to do with your retirement, TIA and CREF. The way it was before this meeting, the university put 10% into the retirement fund, and the individual put in 5%. And he said, I have an idea. And, of course, the 5% was taxable because it was part of your salary. And so he said, I have an idea that I want to share with you. He said, what would you think if the university picked up all 15% of that and you didn't pay into it 5%? Well, of course, everybody was thrilled to death with that idea. He said, well, we were thinking about giving everybody a 5% raise anyway. So it just sounded like good business, and everybody was thrilled to death. And so my TIA and CREF retirement that I get now, except for the first year, all of it was paid by the university. I never had to put anything more in it. Of course, it stopped as far as putting into it when I left Purdue.
Sure.
When we got out to Colorado State, why then there was no more TIA. And yeah, let's see. No.
They had a different retirement.
Colorado had their own retirement system, yeah, okay. Which was not as good as TIA and CREF.
What was the village like, the Chauncey Village? Tell us a little bit about that. And when you were here, was there much activity?
Here, yeah, Chauncey, is that what they call it,
the
Chauncey
village?
Village?
Yeah, they call it the village.
Well, but, you know, I was married when I came here, and my wife didn't let me roam around down there.
We had little children, so we
Children, and we lived out
there. But there were some stores, there were some.
Oh yeah,
there,
but
sure.
nothing.
Nothing like it is now.
Bookstore and a
there was
Chinese
a bookstore, and
that was good.
Yeah. And there was a place where you could buy beer, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And but we were busy, but we always liked it here, and.
Where did you move after the apartment? Did you buy a house?
To Black Hawk Lane. We built a house.
We built a house out on Black Hawk Lane. You know where that is?
Yes, right.
And and we built it in, let's see, 56, no, 58.
What about that?
I don't know. But it was a, we were lucky in that, her brother's an architect, and he designed the house. And so the house is still there. Whenever we come to town, we drive out, drive around, look
sure.
at it.
Did you go to any of the athletic events?
All of them. In those days, we went to all the football games and all the basketball games. Curiously enough, now, I guess it comes with old age, I just don't have the enthusiasm anymore. Plus, the fact that athletics, athletics at Colorado State University are not like they were at Purdue. We could go for years out there and not have a winning team. And here, we always had a winning team. And I'd sit out there in the stadium and rain and snow and sleet. And now as I look back, I said, she was there too, so I can't. She,
I was there.
We just decided that now then we don't do that anymore. I'm getting too old.
The president, Hovde was president when you were here.
Yes.
Did you have any interactions with him?
Yes.
Good.
He was a good man. I think people were kind of awed by him. He got a PhD at Oxford or somewhere in England.
Right, and he had the whole regalia for commencement.
Yes, and he wore his round cap. And he was kind of a very distinguished man. And he was very friendly if you had reason to talk to him. But I didn't go up and say, "Fred, how are you?" You know. But I always felt he was a good man, and they always had a president's reception over on 9th Street or somewhere over there,
where the house was.
Yeah, and we were always invited. And one Sunday a year, wasn't it, that we would go over there and see a lot of the people and. So, no, yeah, President Hovde was I can say this, that I think the administration at Purdue was considerably better than the average. They were just outstanding people. And my dean while I was here was Earl Butz, as you know, is still alive.
Still alive.
Still alive, and I could spend an hour just telling stories about Earl Butz, but...
You want to share one or two come to mind?
Yeah, which one?
It's your call.
One time, he and I were sitting at a banquet, and our wives weren't with us. And Butz says, "Wayne, I hear you're a pretty good teacher." And I said, "Where did you hear that?" And he said, "Well, that's what I heard. That's what I found out." And I said, "Well, how do you find that out?" He said, "Well, I have a little gimmick." When students come in to get their Alpha Zeta paddle signed, you know what Alpha Zeta is, an honorary. And he says, "I ask them a few questions before I'll sign it. The first question," he says, "is, who are the best teachers you've had since you've been here at Purdue?" "Oh, sir, they're all good, you know." And he said, "You didn't understand me, lad." He said, "I ask you for three names of the best teachers that you had." And he wouldn't sign it or let him out of his office until he got three names. And finally, the students would come up with three names. Then they'd think they were off the hook. And then he'd say, "All right, now I want to know the three poorest teachers you've had since you've been here." And of course, nobody wants to say that they're teachers. But he was, as you know, a kind of a hard-nosed man. And he's, "You didn't understand me, lad." He says, "I want to know who are the three poorest students." And he wouldn't let him out of his office until he got three names. And he says, "You know, it's amazing how consistent the three best ones and the three poorest ones were." And he says, "You were always in that top category."
That's nice.
I always remember that. It turned out he was a real good friend of ours while we were here. And Mrs. Butz and Joyce were good friends, and when Earl Butz first came back from Washington, D.C., being Secretary of Agriculture, I had never met him. So I said, "How are you, Dr. Butz or Dean Butz?" He put out my hands. He tapped me on the chest, and he says, "My name is Earl, and don't forget it." And nobody ever, I don't know anybody then that ever called him Dean Butz. It was always Earl. And he was a different kind of dean, but a good one, I felt, for at least for Purdue, he was really good. Mm-hmm. And to have somebody with the kind of professional stature that he had was good for Purdue also.
Sure.
Oh, we'll tell you one more story about it. We were talking about this. When Earl Butz came back from Washington, he said, "It's a great place, this Purdue University." He said, "I just... I'm so happy to get back on the same board again with Butz, Bottom, and Outhouse." There were Butz. Bottom was a professor in ag economics, and Outhouse was a professor in animal science. So he liked to talk about the board, sitting on the board, Butts Bottom and Outhouse. That was Earl Butts.
That sounds like him, right.
Yeah.
Did you serve on any of the committees in the Senate at all when you were here?
Yes. Well, yeah, I was the, what do they call it, faculty council? Yeah, I was on that.
It was a different name or something of that sort.
I don't remember any specific duties, but I do remember coming over, wasn't it over in this building?
It might have been in Stewart, maybe they met.
And, but I enjoyed it. You know, today I would be bored to death if I had to sit in a meeting, but you get that way as you get older and older. But I had a lot of enthusiasm in those days, and I served, they had what they call the Ag Staff Christmas Party. I doubt if they have it anymore, but it was a Christmas party for the Ag College, and they always had a, what would you call it, not mimic the dean, they kind of...
A roast or something?
A roast, that's the word a roast. And I remember one year the roast was for Earl Butts, and it was promoting milk, not coffee. And so people in their offices would, when they knew Butts was coming to their office, they'd hide their coffee pot under their desk somewhere and get out the milk bottle, because Earl was Mr. Ag, you know. So we put that on, and I got to be the chairman of that program committee, and then chairman of the overall Ag Staff Christmas. There were, I don't know how many people came. I'd guess 1,000. It was a...
Where did you hold it?
I don't remember.
Well, some facility.
I think you're getting the fish fry and the...
No, I remember the fish fry, too.
Yeah.
Now they don't... Did you know they don't call it the fish fry now? I think it's the pork fry.
They still use the same name, but
yeah,
they serve
yeah.
pork.
Well, it was over in the...
Armory.
Oh, and they... Oh, they used to roast Dean Butts over there, too, a lot. And I was involved in all kinds of shenanigans over there, too. But go ahead now. We better get back to that.
What were some of your fondest memories that you don't share with...
With Purdue?
Yeah. And thinking
oh,
of
my.
Coming back, anything comes to mind?
Well, one thing is that our children grew up here, and... Two out of the three graduated in here, from here. The other one went here but didn't graduate from here. And our son was on the crew, and so we followed him all over Marietta, Ohio, and wherever they went, and that was fun. And then we got one thing that happened here that I was very appreciative is they were good about giving you sabbatical leaves. And so in the 20 years we were here, I had 2 sabbatical leaves. And the first one was to Sweden, and the second one was to Colorado State University. And Dr. Peterson was gung-ho for sabbatical leaves as long as you would find the person would find the replacement for while you were gone. He got tired of looking for people when somebody said, I'm going to take a sabbatical leave. Do I have permission? Yes, you have permission. And then they take off, and then Dr. Peterson was left high and dry with nobody to take the course. So I had to line up people to take my place while I was gone. But it was there was one other thing. They didn't call it a sabbatical leave. But in 1960, actually it was 59, I ran into a former colleague of mine, graduate student colleague, who taught genetics at the University of Hawaii on the Manoa campus. And I was really quite joking when I said, hey, you must have it rough over there. Make a long story short, I suggested that we trade jobs, that I go to Hawaii and teach summer school over there, and that he come to Purdue and take my job. And I was the guy, I came back and I told Dr. Peterson about this, and he said, I think that sounds like a good idea. I thought he'd tell me you lost your mind, you know. And so he helped me get to Hawaii, and the guy came over here, and he lived in our house and drove our car, and we went to Hawaii and lived in his house and drove his car, and it was a fantastic experience. We've always remembered that stay in Hawaii, and so that was, I guess there's no reason to dwell on that one, but that was really the first time when we got to Hawaii, that was 1960, and that was just the year after Hawaii was named a state. 1959, Hawaii was a state, and so we had some interesting experiences. I remember when the first Japanese warship came into the harbor. Peacetime then, there was still a lot of animosity about that. Wasn't easy to accept them, but we had a great time over there, I remember that I had three courses to teach over there in the summer, and I was busy. I didn't have time to go to the beach or anything, and I call up over here and I'd say, I'd like to talk to Jimmy Bob Smith. That was his name, not James Robert. He was an Oklahoma boy, and he was Jimmy Bob Smith. And they'd say, well, he's out on the golf course. And I said, golf course? Well, it turns out that he taught my summer school class here to 8 or 10 students. And I was over there teaching three classes, each 30 each or something like that. And so he thought it was a great idea to be over here. So it was
a nice experience.
Yeah, it was a nice experience. Yeah. And then, as a matter of fact, our son lives in Hawaii now, has been over there for 30 years. And
it gives you a place to go to.
We go every year. We've been there every year for 30 years. And it's fun to go there. And we know all the islands reasonably well. And so it's...
And then when did you leave Purdue then?
We left Purdue in 75.
Okay, and you went to?
1975, went to Colorado State as department head of agronomy.
Is that in Fort Collins?
Yes.
Okay.
And then that's the land-grant university of Colorado, and it's very similar to Purdue, except it's not as big. We're much smaller than Purdue. Well,
what's the enrollment size?
We
have about 40,000.
Oh, well, we're down to...
Yeah,
I'd say 25. I retired 15 years ago, so I don't...
But you keep an office there?
Yes, well, yeah, they let me. I wrote a history of the department with some other guys, and they let me keep my office. And so I still have stuff in my office, and I go up once or twice a month and sort stuff, trying to get rid of it, because I know they probably need the space. But, yeah, it's been a good experience out there. We miss Purdue. Every once in a while I say, oh, I miss Purdue. But it's a younger college and university. But when we compare the climates of Colorado and Indiana, we're not about to come back.
Anything in closing, any special favorite comments you'd like to make that you can think of?
We're always thrilled to come back to Purdue when we
especially
work.
For the centennial, which is...
Yes, that's right. That's right. And we bought a farm out north of West Lafayette in 1962. And that gives us an excuse to come back. And we always do come back with great enthusiasm, look forward to it. And I think we've been back every summer, except she says last summer we didn't get here. But it's a fun place, and I've always been pleased. I feel a little bit like Purdue is where my career took place. I was 32 when I got here, and I was 52 when I left. And also, when you're a department head, sometimes you wonder about your, I used to joke that half the people thought I was doing a good job out there, and half of them thought I was doing a poor job. And so, but we have still have lots and lots of friends here, and people who were here when we were here, and we see Bill McPhee regularly because his daughter lives in Colorado, and so they come out there. And so when we come here, he's going to be honored, I hear, today.
Oh, that's right.
It's some sort of a...
That's nice. Yeah.
So a great place here.
Well, we're just really, really pleased that we were able to arrange this. It's been very
Thank
nice.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.